Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Dags för lite reklam och veckans avsnitt sponsras av SAS Eurobonus Mastercard, och SAS Eurobonus är ju flygbolagets SAS lojalitetsprogram, och med det här kreditkortet SAS Eurobonus Mastercard så får man Eurobonuspoäng vid alla sina vardagsköp. Så när man handlar på kortet så kan man få upp till 20 extra poäng per 100 kronor, och just nu fram till den 5 maj så kan man få upp till 5000 Eurobonuspoäng när man skaffar då SAS Eurobonus Mastercard. Och de här poängen kan man sedan använda och byta in dem mot flygresor, uppgraderingar, hotellnätter, hyrbilar, loungebesök och mycket, mycket mer. Så man kan gå in på sasurbonusmastercard.se och så testa där. Där kan man liksom fylla i hur mycket pengar lägger på olika saker, på kläder, på mat etc. Hur mycket poäng blir det och vad kan jag sedan byta de här poängen mot? Kreditkortet ges ut av SEB Kort och Bank AB, och den effektiva räntan beräknat på ett kreditbelopp om 40 000 kronor, ett årspris på 515 kronor per år, är 19,27%, det vill säga 47 108 kronor. Och därför är det jätteviktigt att man har koll på alla villkoren, vad som gäller, och man betalar hela räkningen i tid. Så avslutningsvis ett stort tack till SAS Eurobonus Mastercard och SEB som gör Rika Tillsammans möjligt, men framförallt ett stort tack till dig som lyssnar och följer oss varje vecka. Samtidigt som man kan tycka att humankapital är ett högst teoretiskt resonemang, så är det ju ändå det som gör att bankerna ger oss lån på flera miljoner för att köpa en bostad. Det är ju inte bara säkerheten i bostad de vill ha, utan de vill ju ha liksom värdet av vår humankapital, alltså det vill säga de framtida inkomsterna som säkerhet.
Du lyssnar på Rika Tillsammans-podden som handlar om allt som är roligt med privatekonomi. I den här podden får du varje vecka ta del av konkreta tips, råd, verktyg och inspiration för att ta ditt sparande och din privatekonomi till nästa nivå på ett enkelt sätt. Vi som gör den här podden heter Jan och Caroline Bolmesson.
Idag är det dags för avsnitt 270, och idag har vi en gäst. Vi har med Paolo Sodini som är professor på Handelshögskolan i Stockholm, och han var ju med för typ 3 år sedan eller 4 år sedan, och jag kommer ihåg att det är inte så ofta man får ett helt nytt ekonomiskt koncept man aldrig har tänkt på innan, och då för 3 år sedan så introducerade han liksom humankapital, eller liksom värdet av humankapital i form av, vad ska man säga, värdet på alla mina egentligen framtida inkomster. Det är ett strikt matematiskt det är liksom definition, liksom värdet på alla mina liksom framtida löneinkomster, och liksom värdet av min erfarenhet, mina färdigheter och allt det jag kan omsätta i framtida pengar. Och det som är intressant liksom som vi pratar om nu, det är liksom vi tar upp forumets frågor, vad har man för praktisk nytta av det här i livet, hur kan man tänka på det kring risk, till exempel att, ja, men att investera till exempel i samma företag som man jobbar i,
är kanske inte superbra, för att då har man liksom inte, liksom, då har man lagt alla äggen i samma korg, man har inte diversifierat. Så att det blir ett, både ett lite teoretiskt avsnitt men väldigt intressant, men framförallt vad som jag gillar är ju så att när man har en professor på tråden, då kan man ju fråga om liksom så här, det allmänbildande kring sparande, där han liksom, då vi liksom bekräftar, vilket jag tycker är jätteskönt, allt det där, men det bästa sparandet är det som är väldiversifierat, det är billigt, det är brett, det är svårt att tajma marknaden, de flesta bör inte göra det. Och sen, och då ska man ändå säga att det är ganska mycket sagt för en professor, för jag vet ju, du är ju också forskare ju.
Ja, jag har varit forskare.
Ja, och då ogillar man ju säga så här, liksom så här, att inte problematisera, utan att liksom, man vill gärna säga, men det beror på, eller så här. Men konsensus inom forskning är liksom, när det gäller hur man ska investera, ändå så pass tydlig att han är så här, nej men billiga, liksom breda liksom indexfonder att investera över.
Ja, det är inte så mycket tvekan kring det, nej.
Nej, liksom.
Nej, men jag gillade också att avsnittet som ni nu ska lyssna på, att han pratar om att det har hänt mycket på den här fronten med humankapital, ja, forskningsmässigt sen vi pratade sist. Ja. Och det är jättekul.
Ja, men eller hur, eller hur. Bra, så jag tänker att vi behöver nog inte prata så mycket mer. Paolo är från Italien, så att avsnittet är på engelska. Så att, jag ber om ursäkt i förväg för min dåliga engelska här, att ni får stå ut med det. Där finns en transkribering på engelska på bloggen, men vi har liksom inte gjort någon översättning än, och ingen dubbning eller något sådant. Utan jag tänker att nästa vecka är vi annars tillbaka med ett avsnitt på svenska, så att liksom, om man tycker att det är jobbigt att lyssna på, så kan man läsa det mer på engelska eller bara liksom hoppa avsnittet. Så ett stort tack, och liksom, och jag vill också säga alltid som vanligt, stort tack till dig i Patreon-communityn som stödjer oss, som sponsrar oss, som gör sådana här avsnitt möjliga, så att liksom vi kan ha de här intervjuerna, vi kan ha detta avsnittet som typ man aldrig hade hört annars.
Nej.
Tänker jag. Så att för dig som vill läsa mer om Patreon-communityn, så finns det en länk i beskrivningen. Och naturligtvis så är det inte bara att liksom så, man sponsrar eller stödjer oss, utan du får liksom också en struktur för din ekonomi på liksom årsbasis. Det är typ som en utbildning, du får massa tillfällen, vi kommer ha träffar i Stockholm och i Malmö nu i vinter,
ja,
och vi har digitala träffar, så att du får en massa annat på köpet också. Så med det sagt, så tänker jag att vi släpper på Paolo här. Welcome back, Professor Paolo Sodini. You are a professor at the Stockholm School of Economics, and you're as well the director of the Swedish House of Finance and the Institute of Micro Data at SSE. And as well as one of the founders of the European Network of Household Finance. And as I've understood it, that your research focuses primarily on asset pricing and household finance. And you have published several papers in top economic journals. And you have a PhD from Massachusetts Institute of Technology, also known as MIT. Yes. So very welcome. Something you want to add?
Thank you. Yeah, I'm not the director of the Swedish House of Finance. That's the only thing that's not true.
Ah, sorry about that.
The rest is correct.
I hope that that's okay. But so you focus primarily on human capital, and that's like the main theme for this episode. And we've gotten like several questions from our readers, etc. But I would like to have like some, just for the new listeners, like some common views on like savings and retail. How can one think about one's finances, like from the academia view? And I also want to make sure that like, this is not financial advice. This is just like a discussion, subjective view. And as Caroline said, Caroline has a PhD as well in biology.
Yes.
And she said like, this is not like a defense of PhD defense. This is just like popular, more illustrerad vetenskap than something else. But as a person coming from academia, what would you say are the most important ideas for someone who's never been like in finance and economics, if in an academic perspective? What would you say are the most important ideas?
You mean like in terms of for investing?
Yeah, for a normal person.
How to set up how to save and things like that. Actually, it's very simple. I mean, there are two things you have to do, or three things I would say you have to do. You have to decide, first of all, how much should you keep in safe assets versus risky assets? So how much keep in, you know, safe bonds or short-term bond funds, and how much to invest instead in stocks, if we take like the most popular risky asset class. And that we'll talk a lot about, and human capital has a huge effect on that. But obviously it depends on your risk attitude, in, you know, how much risk you're willing to take. It depends how much money you need for your daily life. You should make sure you have enough liquid or money in safe assets that you can use, that you need to, so that you can kind of carry on your daily life. And also if there are some emergencies, you know, that you have enough money to kind of face them. So that's the first thing, how much risk you take to take. And the second one, once you decide the fraction you want to invest in risky assets, I think the recommendation is always the same. It's diversify, diversify, diversify. And nowadays there are fantastic vehicles through which you can diversify your portfolio. You can buy, you know, world index funds for a few basis points. Thank God we are out of this world, also in Sweden, where you had to invest to pay 1.5-2% to invest in a diversified mutual fund. I would say try to focus on mutual funds that are offered by reputable providers, because execution in terms of taking down costs and making sure that the fund really follows a diversified index are crucial, and worldwide access to trading platform and so on and so forth. So large institutions have those possibilities. And then the third thing is rebalance your portfolio. Don't try to outguess how the market, what the market will do. It's extremely difficult to figure out where the market is going, whether it's the right moment to buy or to sell. I would say very, you know, just do it in an automatic way. When the market goes down, the share of your investment in risky assets is gonna shrink. So bring it up to the share you want, to your target. And similarly, when the market is booming, then the share investing in risky assets and stocks will automatically increase, simply because they're valued more and more. The market is booming. Take it back to the level that you had. And you can do this regularly, like, but even if you do it once per year, it's a big difference. I would say like every three months or something like that. You don't need a lot. Don't think about outguessing. Just use the simple rule, and then you see it automatically. You buy cheap and you sell when things are expensive, when things are valued a lot of money, which is in a way what you would try to do by outguessing when to buy and to sell. But since it's so difficult to predict where the market is going, this simple rule may kind of get away with it. Will give you a lot without sweating and without making big mistakes. Don't panic when the market is down. The market is cheap, okay? And don't jump into the market or invest more when its valuations are very, very high. I mean, you know, then there is exuberance and people think things are fantastic, are going up. Well, you know, if they go up, they will go down as well. So, and since it's so difficult to forecast, I think the best way is to use this rebalancing rule.
Mm. I find this very interesting, because in academia and for investors that have invested for a long time, everybody agrees on it's difficult to forecast, you shouldn't outguess the market. But if you then talk to like the finance industry, or you talked about a lot of like interested private persons or retail investors, they always like they have almost the opposite view. So why would you say it's so difficult? What makes it so difficult to try to forecast or outguess the market?
I mean, there is an enormous amount of volatility. And so if the market goes up and down, tremendously. And to differentiate whether it's just the expression of the uncertainty there is in the market when you see going up and down, or whether there is a trend manifesting itself, I think it's extremely difficult. And I I think it's not something an individual should try to do just by looking at the news. Remember, like, whatever you hear, it's public and it's already incorporated in the prices most likely. So, of course, if you have privileged information, if you have, you know, the possibility of accessing tools that can analyze trends or information that is not available publicly, it's not obviously available publicly, then you know, it might be possible. But I would say that to do it accurately and really being able to claim that you're able to outguess when it's the right moment to buy and sell, I think it's extremely difficult. It's not something an individual investor can do. Plus, I mean, we see that professional managers are also not good at it. I mean, there is a lot of research in finance show that, you know, typically active investing doesn't add much, or if anything, after costs, you know, creates generate lower returns than you see in you know, passive mutual funds or you know, passive investing or index mutual fund.
Why do you think we keep trying then?
I think it's that's the way the industry can sell itself. As simple as that. There is a lot of interest in the opposite direction. I mean, if all these, why would they need all these professionals to just follow the recommendation I gave you? What would you write on the newspapers every day? I think it's simple. The recipe is simple, but it's extremely difficult to prove that it's the right recipe, the one I gave you. So, of course, I mean, you know, how difficult can it be to sell high and buy low, you know, especially if we look at individual stocks. And my friends told me that actually this is the year for that company. And, you know, I heard from this other friend who actually knows someone in the bank that, you know, I should invest in gold, you know. Yeah. It's like, yeah, there are zillions of opinions, but, you know, it's extremely difficult. There is a fundamental law which we know it's not working 100%, but it's still extremely powerful, which is the efficient market hypothesis. Information is incorporated in prices. So, like, just think about this. This is a good company. I should invest in it. Well, it depends on which price you buy it. You know, if everyone knows it's a good company, the company is going to be highly valued anyway, and this will not give you such a high return. Maybe you're paying too much because everyone thinks it's a good company, and they actually carried away with some news that just came out publicly, and it maybe is not representative of the overall prospect of the company, you know. So I think it's a little bit how the industry is built, and that's I think actually a problem.
And I think, like, one of the main issues, as I've seen when I've read like several papers, is like to try to differentiate luck from skill. In when you look on his historical performance, and I have a faint memory that you said, like, when you visited us last time, that you need like an obscene amount of time in order to be able to say something definitely.
Yeah, exactly. So the problem is that since there is so much volatility in the market, so it goes up and down. I mean, it goes up and down so much. To really figure out what on average you will receive from a specific investment or from the overall market even, it's very challenging from a simple statistical point of view. So so what I think I told you, or what I tend to tell to my students, is that if we take the world index, which is, since it's so diversified, it has the least volatility, so it moves around not that much, and we're talking about 15% or something like that. And then we take all the data we have, which is about 100, 150 years of data. Then we really can't place how much the stock market gives you above the bond market. We can't place it. We could place it anywhere between 4 and 8%. You know, and of course, I mean, the estimate is about 6, 5.5, something like that, but it's not at all precise. Not at all precise. In fact, I don't know if it is 4, if it is 8. And, you know, If you invest in pension, for your pension you receive 4%, you have one pension. If you receive 8%, you have a completely different pension. So we're not talking peanuts here. Now, let's take a mutual fund manager, and let's say that this person has been the typical pitch. I mean, this person has a lot of experience, has been out there for 10 years. And I'm going to try to see whether this person can beat the benchmark. 10 years is not much. You have the same problem. That's a completely different story. The other thing, the kind of, it's kind of the other statistical fact that is kind of a little bit shocking, that if I would like to make sure that the equity premium, if I would like to have an estimate of whether the equity premium, so how much stocks earn over bonds, is between 5.5 and 6.5%. So I just want to have a 1% bound around 6%. I need 3,000 years of data with that volatility. So we would need to go back to Egyptian time. Of course, you know, the stock market, first of all, didn't exist, but second, you know, it's probably what happened in Egyptian time and in Roman time. It's not representative of what's happening today. So you also have this trade-off between the fact that the economy, the world, our society changes dramatically, and taking data that goes back a long time is difficult, is maybe not representative of what's happening now. So that's a curse, but this allows, people quoting very good performances that in fact we can't really statistically say whether they are so. If I statistically I can't really say whether the manager is good or bad, and there were tons of research showing that's extremely difficult to distinguish a skill versus luck for this reason, then the next best thing is to explain that you have something really good under your hand. So you follow a strategy that is winning, that there is an asset class that is going to do very well for whatever reason. Hence, all the talking and all the discussions and the different products that we see in the retail industry and in the media. Mm. Now, I'm not saying that one can build more sophisticated portfolios than just diversified and rebalance. I mean, you should take care of inflation, you might have a mortgage, you have interest rate. I mean, there is a lot of things you can do, but they are not in the vein of this is going to be the next big thing, or now the market is going to tank. I mean, just think about the COVID, what happened with COVID, right? We had a huge drop, and everyone was in panic. The world is different. It's going to be different forever. And then, best performance ever.
Afterwards. Yeah, six months later.
Yes. And again, I hate to say this. This is just an example. I mean, it doesn't mean anything, right? But it's kind of representative of what we know is in the data.
Mm. Yeah.
I'm a little bit orthodox on this, but I think that when it comes to retail investing, I think it's fair. It's fair to put it this way. Otherwise, people go after all sorts of things, and then in the end, they lose a lot of money.
Yeah. I don't know if you read did you see the Bessembinder studies? I think it was like some Dutch professor. He realized that the equity premium, or he asked the question, do stocks beat bonds over a long time? And I think his result was that it was, 2% or 4% of all stocks on the S&P 500 over 70 years stood for 100% of the equity premium. So it was like really, really few companies, which also was in favor of like owning the whole haystack instead of trying to look for the needles. Yeah. But I think
there is a nice analogy that I like a lot. It's not mine. As you try to find out the best tree, you forget the whole forest is growing.
Yeah.
It's much better to invest in the whole forest rather than picking the wrong tree that might actually, for some reason fall down or, have some diseases or whatever.
Exactly. I would just like walk back to also the emergency fund. Is there like any
emergency
point?
Fund.
Yeah, you said like you should divide how much for emergencies or like...
Oh, you mean buffer fund.
Yeah. Mm. Are there any like from academia, any pointers how one should think about that?
There aren't... how should you think about that? Yes, there are two aspects, I would say. The first one is you should decide what is minimum for you. Okay, that's the first. So everything goes really bad. I need to survive for this many months, and I need this amount of money. Okay, so this means that you have a sense what it means to for things go really badly. So, you know, if you have unemployment insurance and so on and so forth, you know, unemployment benefit, then, or, you know, some type of floor to how much you can earn. There is one discussion. There are some needs. If you instead might, you know, lose entirely your job without this type of parachuting, then it's a completely different discussion. But that's the first thing. So the second thing, and then, you know, then you have to consider things might break, right? So if my car breaks, whatever, you know, and I really need it, I can't stay a month without it or whatever, then I need those money. So that's the first layer. The second layer is what we call habit. So you grow accustomed to a certain standard of living. And you have a series of expansion, I would call them consumption commitments. Okay, this can be of all sorts of things. I want to have a certain house with a certain, you know, style. I don't want to, or in a certain neighborhood, I don't want to downsize. I have a family. I need to provide for my family. You know, all these type of arguments. That's more like, you know, making sure that you have enough money to maintain your standard of living. And this obviously, you know, affects how much you want to put in risky assets versus keep it in safe assets, precisely because you want to feel safe enough from that point of view. So I would say these are the two criteria but it's very individual, you know, especially the second one. So it's difficult to give a general rule, like you need 3 months of salary. Yeah, perhaps in Sweden, if you have unemployment insurance, blah, 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 then yes. But, you know, it's something you have to sit down and think about, you know, having this kind of, you know, kind of arguments in the back of your mind.
Yeah. Yeah, I normally say it's like very different if you're single and a student or if you have a house and a family and 2 kids.
Exactly.
It's completely different answers.
And whether you like to drive, you know, fancy cars or you're happy without any, or you have a boat or not and so forth.
Exactly. Two last questions before we go into human capital. As I understand it, the academia view is like we talked about owning the whole forest. We got 2 questions from JR and Matthias, and they wonder, like, do you have an opinion of assets that are missing, like a natural dividend, such as e.g. gold or commodities or natural resources? Like, would you count them into the efficient market hypothesis? Are they included, kind of?
Well, I mean, I think you should diversify across not only, I mean, so there are various asset classes, right? So you have commodities, you have the stock market, you have, you know, private equity, for example, you have real estate. So there's a lot of stuff you should invest. If you really want to diversify your portfolio, then you should go all over the place. Now, one issue is that, or one way why this might not be very extremely important, let's put it this way, or why you don't need it necessarily, is that in the stock market, you have a lot of companies that actually, you know, whose return is representative of those asset classes. So you have REITs, for example, you have commercial real estate companies, you have oil companies, you have, you know, all sorts of companies that actually rely on prime materials. And so you might want, and similarly, you have investment companies that invest in private equity. So by investing in the stock market in them, indirectly, you will have access to these other asset classes. So one might argue that, you know, as a first step, investing in the stock market is really important. And then the second issue, and you have access to all this type of stuff through the stock market, because companies that actually rely on these alternative asset classes or work in those fields. The second step is to decide in which proportion to put these things together. And then, you know, the stock market is easy because you have, you know, companies have a certain market cap that is kind of representative of how well they are doing. And there is a market portfolio. So if you just invest in the world index, then, you know, you are kind of all set. in that sense. When how much should I invest in gold? It becomes difficult to decide. But also be too precise on how much you should invest in each company is we know it's not super crucial. This famous paper by Raman Upal that's fascinating, where he just tests the 1/n rule. So he takes several asset classes, he defines them in very different ways, and then he builds a portfolio of 1/n. So like if he has 3 asset classes, 1/3, 1/3, 1/3, if he has 5, whatever. And then he shows that this actually tends to do much better than optimizing your portfolio, finding the optimal mean variance solution in each period. Okay. And the reason is basically there's so much noise on the returns, the mean returns over which you optimize, that at the end of the day, by fine tuning, you do worse than just having a strategy that doesn't trade that much and so forth. One advantage of investing in an index is that you don't need to rebalance across asset class. So if you have 1/n rule, and one class becomes too large, then you have to rebalance your portfolio. That's done automatically in a market. If you invest in the overall market, so the market in a way chooses how to allocate the money. But I think sure, you should diversify. Then should you invest a lot in gold right now or not? I mean, personally, I don't know, and I think it's very difficult to figure it out. As I told you before.
Mm. Oh, cool. So if we go into the human capital, for me, that was like a real eye-opener 3.5 years ago. And it has been kind of following me since.
Was it that long ago?
Yeah, it was actually 3.5 years ago. Yeah. It was episode 80.
We have been discussing this.
Yeah, we have been discussing this and referencing back to you. But what you basically said, so this is like always, I always feel nervous like saying something back to a professor, but I think you said that households can count on 2 main type of resources over the lifetime, like the tangible wealth, which I understand as funds, stocks, real estate, the house you live in, etc., like accumulated from the savings and inheritance. And then you have the human capital. And then I think you defined the human capital as the main source of lifetime income for most household, and it's typically non-traded, carries. Yeah, we don't need to go into that later. So how would you define this? Like, why is human capital such an important concept?
Yeah, so let me step back a little bit.
Yes.
Because, again, this is just a diversification argument, okay? Nothing more than that. So I think we all agree that we shouldn't take assets, we discussed it up to now, we shouldn't take assets in isolation. When you build a portfolio, you put together assets that have different cash flow, and these cash flow interact with each other. And when you whoever is going to build the portfolio for you is going to take into account the overall interaction of all these assets. The overall cash flow comes out from them being in the same portfolio together. And basically that's the idea of diversification. It's like, by diversifying, you reduce risk dramatically, you eliminate idiosyncratic risk, but you don't have much of an impact on returns. Okay, so that's kind of the idea. That's a big win-win situation that you have by diversifying your portfolio. Now, so if we agree that when we invest, we need to take into account the combination of cash flow of our investment, then we should not forget that all of us are endowed with an asset, which is human capital, that has probably the largest cash flow that we receive over the life cycle, which is salaries, earnings. And if you think about it, like when I decide how to invest in financial assets, not taking into account how those cash flow of my invest interact with the one that I have, that I will receive for sure by working, it's something that fails the basic principles of finance by a large magnitude. And this becomes particularly important because this, the earnings, you know, how much you're going to earn by working, it's an enormous amount of money. And it lasts for a very long time, throughout your life, in fact. And, you know, of course you work until 65, but while you work, you also, you know, save for pension. So all the money you receive for pension are coming from your work as well. So it's the whole life cycle. And the only claim, the only important thing to just grasp to understand why it's so important human capital in investment decision is that, you know, as when we build our portfolio, we need to consider how all these assets cash flow interact. We should also consider how they interact with the cash flow that we receive from working, which is something that we have for sure, and it's huge.
Mm. But I think like when I try to explain this to people, I'm not doing as good job as you, but I sometimes get the question, like we got it here from Daniel, and he was like, what's like, for me, it's interesting, like, knowing it, but what do I do like practically with it? Do I, like, because he says like, this won't affect my investment decision because I can get ill or unemployed, I can lose my human capital, and like, so how do you, like, no, this, most this people it was like, it, this is a good idea, but how do you, what do I do with it?
Yeah, it's a very important question, and also I'm super happy to talk about this again in this podcast, because since last time we learned a lot in academia. There are very important advances in the last 3 years that I would like to share with you, which also changed the way I kind of approach how to consider human capital in your investment. Okay. So first of all, so there are a few things to say. First of all, we need to remember what human capital is. Human capital is basically the value of all this stream of earnings, right, that you will receive. It is extremely difficult to evaluate because you have to forecast how much an individual is going to earn throughout his or her life. And then you need to discount it to today and need to find the appropriate discount factor and so forth. There is a literature trying to do that. There are various ways to do it. So, you know, for a single person, really, the estimate can vary wildly, but we know it's very large. So for someone that has finished college education in Sweden, I would say that it's more than 10 million krona when you are about 25. And then even though it's difficult to quantify, so we know it's a lot for most people compared to the liquid assets they have, especially at the beginning of their career, it's a lot of money. It's a very large asset. And naturally, because you earn a lot over your life cycle. The second is, and there is a lot of uncertainty how much this is really worth. I mean, is it 10, 15, 8? Okay, we don't know. It's difficult to formulate. But we know how it evolves over time. And so just think about it. As you grow older, you have less and less years to earn money on, to less year of working life, which means that the value of human capital tends to shrink over time. At the beginning, it might increase because your salary goes up. So basically, you take the present value of higher and higher wages, but then eventually it has to go down. So typical, you know, over the life cycle, you typically see human capital might go up until 30 or something, depends on how steep is your earning profile. But then it has to go down slowly. And then if we take 10 at 25, 30 as an estimate, then when you're 65, you're about 3 million left. Okay, just to give us an idea. So it's still substantial for a lot of people, even later in life. But we know it has this kind of declining for sure pattern.
Can I try something on you, Paolo? So this is, I've been thinking for this for 3 years, okay? So because what I try to illustrate this for our viewers, so I'm going to share a graph. So this is like very basic, normal discounting. And I took like a normal Swedish person. I'm going to show you this.
So this is like a 40-year-old Swedish Anna. She has 25 years to pension, and we said she earns 25,000 after tax. And then I took a discount rate of 3%.
And then you assume that she will earn 300,000.
The same, yeah, the same salary.
This is why it just goes down. You know, yes. If the salary would go up, then you would have at the beginning it goes up and then it goes down.
Yes.
And yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
It makes sense. And I took the 3% because I read somewhere that insurance companies, when they discount, they use between 1% to 3%. So I was like, okay, let's try to use that.
It's very difficult to figure out what that rate is.
Yes.
It depends from person to person, but, you know, just for the sake of the argument.
Yeah, exactly.
Then you get this type of numbers very easily.
Yes. Yeah. So we can say that we don't know if it's like 5 million or like, and for the sake of argument, I would say it doesn't really matter if it's 5.5 or 6 or 7. Is that correct? Could one argue?
The only thing I would say here that, you know, as she earns this 300,000, probably something about, I mean, there is a bunch of money that goes into pension.
Yeah. Because
which it actually earns, and you haven't included it here. That's why it goes to zero at 65. But you should take that into account too, you know.
Exactly. Because that was what I thought like later, because she gets like the pension capital, which actually kicks in as an income after 65. So
should be already in the 5 million at the beginning. You should discount the whole thing all the way to 85.
Ah, okay. Okay, yeah, so I would add it. Because this maybe, and this is maybe wrong, but what I noticed, like if you add the pension capital from the beginning, as I did here, then we get like the financial capital and the human capital is approximately, in the Swedish system, pension system, and this is for me was, and for us on in the forum was a big surprise, because how the Swedish pension system is designed with the 4.5% tjänstepension and the income pension and stuff, is that these 18% kind of compensates for the decline in human capital.
Yeah, but to me, it's all human capital. That's actually, if you go to the first graph, you start kicking in how much money you're going to, you know, the second, go more, that one.
Yeah.
That black is actually part of the, it should be from the beginning added to the blue. Because it's like, imagine a world where the money that we receive for pension are not coming from out of nowhere. Okay, no. We have a pay-as-you-go for, you know, the AP funds and so forth. But I mean, you know, they are coming out of savings that are earned through your labor income.
Yeah.
So it's just, instead of earning it now, you earn it later, but it's still labor income. And you know, it's just that we have designed a system in Sweden that the amount of money that have to be put in pension is decided. That's not true for the US, for example. It's up to you how much you save for pension, right? So that graph.
Yeah, and that's what I tried to illustrate here. And it's not that important because we have the podcast listener who's not watching the graphs. But what I was thinking about, and maybe this is like wrong, this is why I'm trying this on, like just throwing it at you. But for me, could one say that one of the financial goals or economical goals in life is to kind of convert your human capital into financial capital? Because if your human capital is labor income, as in the salary you get for the work you do, so then you should, like, as your human capital declines, your financial capital increases.
Exactly.
And
absolutely.
And as we can see here in the Swedish pension system, somebody should get the Friday cake because they manage to keep it almost at the same level throughout life, given that you work and like the other assumptions. Could one reason?
I mean, I'm not sure about this graph that you show me now, because I think I would rephrase it. Pension for me is part of human capital, so it would look differently. Okay.
Yeah.
But definitely, you know, you that is exactly what's happening. You have human capital at the beginning, right? Which is the present value of how much you're going to earn. And as this kind of decreases over time, the amount you save also in pension increases. Okay. And that's kind of your financial capital, or, you know, liquid capital, which is, you know, partially in pension, partially in current saving. And this is precisely because as financial wealth becomes larger and larger, then, you know, the role of human capital in your investment decision is going to be less, you know, smaller and smaller. Okay.
Yeah.
And in fact, maybe we can go to the recommendations, but like, absolutely, this is crucial. This is exactly what's happening.
Yeah.
The alternative is to actually not save. Then you only have human capital, which will decline forever. And then you will not have, you know, if there is no pension system, you're not forced to save. You will end up, you know, at 65 without anything to live on.
Yeah. I want to show you like one more thing, and maybe I don't want you to say this is correct or just like the thought thought process. So this is from Avanza, you know, the bank that they publish like sometimes what is the average net worth of their individuals throughout different years and or different age. And I understand this is not like the whole capital of the persons. This is just what they have at the Avanza bank. This is like the only figures I am able to find on wealth through different age groups. Yeah. But for me, it was very interesting when I put this into relation with human capital, because until you're like 55, if we look at the amounts that people have at Avanza, they are like totally insignificant compared to the human capital.
But this is the argument I was making before, that like even late in life, it's a huge asset that you have. And so, you know, you have to take it into account when you decide how to invest your money.
Yeah. And for me, that was like the big takeaway when we met last time, because I try to save more like, okay, I shouldn't have all my money in stocks because I should have some like bonds, or I should be like, you never know what happens. I want to protect from volatility. But if I take into account the human capital, and it's like, it doesn't really matter. I could have
That it doesn't matter because eventually, I mean, first of all, if you want to have some ideas of how much wealth people have over time, over the life cycle, we have good statistics back up to 2007. Then, unfortunately, they stopped collecting the data. There you have some. I mean, I have some papers on you know the wealth distribution and stuff. So you can see there, you know, how much money people have. And I think we have some graphs by age as well. At least I show it in my course.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
So that's one thing. But like, as your human capital goes down and you save, especially given how much you're forced to save in pension, your financial wealth increases dramatically. And so then you're left only with financial assets, basically. Okay. And this means that you know how you invest those money becomes very important later on. At the beginning, it becomes very simple. When you have almost only human capital, then the only question you have to ask is like, which type of human capital do I have? And this will give you guidance on how to invest the little money you have in your financial wealth, which over time will grow. But I would say like, so this is what I was going to go to. Once we understand the human capital is large, and I think we made this point through your graph and what I was saying before, and we understand that it declines over time, even though it becomes very, it's still very large in your 50s, okay? The next question is, you know, what should we do about it? And then the issue is like, what type of risk does human capital entail? Because this cash flow is not, you know, that you earn it for sure. There is unemployment, there is, your career can go well, can go badly. There are all sorts of things that happen. And how the riskiness you have in human capital, how does this affect, you know, how much you should invest in your tangible assets, the portfolio you're building, the financial wealth you're accumulating over time. And as this wealth becomes larger and larger, you know, obviously human capital becomes less important, but you have to consider the two things together. And here is where, so let's spend a little bit of time to think about the risk you have in human capital, because we have actually changed a little bit our view in academia compared to when we talked the last time. So if we take the average person and we look at the labor or earnings over the life cycle, and then we see, we try to understand how correlated they are with the stock market, the answer is overwhelmingly almost nothing, okay? So most of the risk that you have in your earnings is idiosyncratic. It's something that happens in your sector, it's something that happens to you, because you know you might get sick, or you know your skills might become obsolete, and so on and so forth. But they are not that correlated with the business cycle or how the stock market changes over time. Which made me, last time we met, conclude that you are like a wandering bond. Basically, you have this. You know, most of the risk is idiosyncratic. Things can happen, but you know it doesn't correlate with the stock market. So you have to consider you have this lot of money that gives you cash flow that is uncorrelated with the market. Hence, you know, you should invest aggressively in the market, in the stock market, if you have a lot of that, especially if you have a lot of human capital, which means early in life. But as we said, it can be very large until you're 50 or whatever. Okay, so now, what happened is that we understood that we were measuring risk in the wrong way. So, and this is also because now we have data, especially in the US, on wage, very precise data on earnings. It wasn't there. We used to have information only from surveys. Now in the US, in Sweden for a long time, we have information on earnings. It comes from administrative sources in the US, the tax system. And so, you know, people could actually, you know, look into much more into detail of type of risk that earnings entail, having an enormous amount of observations and so forth, and going back in time for many, many years. And what we find out that actually there is a lot of skewness, we call it, in the labor market, okay? Which means that when times are good, you know, more and more people earn a lot. When times are bad, more and more people tend to lose the job even, or earn much less. The average doesn't get affected that much, but there is this skewness that moves around in the labor market. And this skewness is highly correlated with the stock market. So, and we call it cyclical skewness. So what happens is that, I mean, in very simple terms, this is a little bit academia in a nutshell, you know, it took us forever to arrive to an obvious conclusion. It's like, basically, when the stock market goes down, or when the business cycle is like when the business cycle is bad, then we see a lot of unemployment. Okay, so that's called right skewness. All right, and when the stock market goes well, we see people, actually a bunch of people, earning a lot of money. Okay, more and more people earning a lot of money. So there is this, and this type of risk moves a lot with the stock market. Okay, and in our models, we were not considering it. We were not considering cyclical skewness, or the fact that skewness in the stock, in the labor market, and how the resources are redistributed in the labor market move a lot with the stock market and with the business cycle. we did not consider that. We were just taking the correlation, but the correlation takes the average guy, and the average guy is actually is not that affected, okay? So it's really, it was just a different way of thinking about risk. It's a little bit obvious exposed, but...
It's always in hindsight.
Yeah, it's always in hindsight. And then Sylvain Catherine wrote a model where you try to find out what is the optimal behavior of your, how you should invest once you consider taking into account cyclical skewness, this new source of risk that we discover. And this has devastating effects. Then you're not anymore a wandering bond. So when you are, on average, when you're young, you shouldn't be as aggressive because actually there is quite a bit of cyclical skewness going around. But especially what is important is that this cyclical skewness changes dramatically from one sector to the other. So the construction sector, for example, it's almost obvious. It has a lot of cyclical skewness. The public sector, none. So you're not a wandering bond if you're in construction.
Yeah.
And you are a wandering bond if you are in the public sector, okay? So that's the way you should think. So basically, you know, now if you have a lot of human capital is very risky in the sense that I told you, then you shouldn't be as aggressive in investing in the stock market when you're young, okay? And similarly, at the same time, if you are in the public sector, in a sector that is very stable, there isn't much unemployment going back and forth, and depending on what happens in the business cycle, then you can definitely, you know, once you've taken care of your buffer, you know, invest aggressively in the stock market, because this human capital you're sitting on, it's very, very safe. And so it would prompt you to invest aggressively in financial wealth. You know, of course, as human capital goes down, the bond part of your total wealth goes down, and so you should reduce your investment in risky asset in the financial part of it, okay? Even if you're wandering bond. And if you are in the construction sector, you should be careful. And as your human capital goes down, maybe you can become more aggressive actually in the stock market if you have saved enough money. So that's how practically we can think about it. Depends where, in which sector you are. And we also know which type of risk you should look at. It's not like, oh, is my sector correlated? No, it's just, does my sector have a lot of unemployment, a lot of downside in, you know, bonuses or whatever? I mean, you know, when the stock market goes down or when a business cycle is down or not? That's the question. And then based on that, you know, human capital is enormous at the beginning and it goes down towards as you approach retirement.
And because this was also a discussion we had after the episode in the forum, was like, how should one think about insurance contracts? For instance, like life or accident or health or like things that affect the human capital. Because I think like if I get unemployed, if I'm the construction worker, then it's maybe a better option to choose like unemployment insurance.
Absolutely. So now all this depends, as I said, like all this cyclical skewness, I mean, it's highly dampened if you have unemployment insurance, if you have, for example, insure your mortgage, you know, and things like that. And the more cyclical skewness you have in your sector, the more you should, you know, cater to this type of insurances. In order precisely to make you, it's going to make you my capital safer, and then we'll go back to the wandering bond, you know. But I have actually a paper with, which is now under review, in one of the top journals, like together with Sylvain Catherine and Yapei Zhang, where we actually try to see whether in the data people feel that they shouldn't be as aggressive if they are in sector that has a lot of cyclical skewness versus sectors that are rather safe in that sense. And we use various measures of risk. We use the correlation, as we used to do, which varies a little bit across sectors, you know, but not dramatically. We use the cyclical variance, which is how much dispersion there is in labor income, in earnings over time in a certain sector. You know, that also moves, you know, periods where things are bad, people tend to have, you know, more concentrated volatility and so forth. And then we use cyclical skewness. We find that actually cyclical skewness has an enormous effect on the probability that people participate in the stock market in a certain sector. So if you are in a sector which is has low cyclical skewness, then you know, or people that are in secondary in Sweden, they actually tend to invest less in the stock market, as we would have predicted. And I think it makes sense because you have a sense that you're sitting on something, that your earnings are not as safe as if you would be in the public sector, and then this prompts you to take less risk on the stock market. So it seems actually people have gotten this, and so now we have it also aligned with academia.
But how do you know which sector you're in? Like if it's a
construction, manufacturing. I think it's a, you know, actually we are writing, we're revising the paper, and we're going to make the list we have of the sectors. It's like 13 sectors plus times three times. It's, you have to think also your level of education. So it's depending on your level of education, different sectors are exposed to different levels of risk. So you can be in a very safe sector, but if you have a high managerial position, actually you might, you know, be fired very easily, and so on and so forth. So I don't have a list, but you know,
but all the parents that tell their kids to go safe and become a doctor or a teacher, dentist, they were right all along.
Well, I mean, in terms of having a safe job, yes, you know, I'm not saying that you shouldn't take risky jobs at all. No, I'm just saying, I think it's, you know, people should follow what they like to do and what they are talented for. I mean,
absolutely.
Remember, so human capital is the set or the stock of all traits, characteristics such as, you know, personality, skill, education, health, that are embodied in the ability of earning money. So the first thing is that you should match with the job that you are done for, if you want, or you study or you burn for, you know. That's the first thing I would say, but, you know, this is not finance, so it's talking to my daughter.
Kinds of studies can help us understand better how to manage our finances in the life that we have chosen.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Exactly. Given where you are,
yes,
then, you know, this is what you should do with your finances. And this is another thing about human capital. You know, it doesn't strike as an asset because it doesn't have a price. And in fact, there is no market for it. That's why it's so difficult to value it, right? So in a large part, you're stuck with it. And if you want the price to acquire human capital, what is it? It's not really that you pay money. Yeah, you might pay tuition, you know, in the United States, for example, you have to pay a lot of money to get a good education. But it's through your education, it's through your learning on the job, it's through, you know, how curious you are when you work and so on and so forth. So it's like very intangible how you acquire it. The price is in terms of what you didn't do otherwise, it's in terms of opportunity cost. But compared to other assets, where you just pay a price, you buy a house, you pay, and you get the house. You buy a stock, you pay, you get the stock. But in terms of providing you with a cash flow, which is the longest we have in our life cycle, it's exactly like any other asset. And that has to be considered when you invest.
And I've thought about it like for these years, because what I just thought of once was that, for instance, if you go to a bank and to get a mortgage, then they look at your human capital. They don't say it, that we are valuing your human capital, but they ask you, like, do you have steady employment? What is your salary? Exactly. And they have your cost. So they actually do the calculations.
Because the reason why you can take that mortgage is that you have this cash flow that is going to pay service in it over time. And for them, it's crucial to know that you have that. And then on top of it, you have collateral, right? So that's another thing. So human capital, it's difficult to collateralize. I think the only setting in which you do is when you take a student loan. But apart from that, you need other collateral, right? But you do have that human capital, and the world is not collapsing, even though we are sitting in a lot of debt, precisely for that reason.
Exactly. I read somewhere like 4,000 years ago, you could collateralize it. Then you get to, like, into slave labor, or if you didn't pay your debts.
There would be. If you could sell your human capital at once, that would be kind of, you know, close to slavery. That's the problem. But there are also, like, it would be fantastic to have a market, if you want. And there is a beautiful book by Schiller, actually, on missing markets. And he talks about whether it would be possible to create market for for labor income in a way, you know, for this missing. So why don't we? And the problem, the big problem is obviously incentives, right? If I sell to you all the stream of cash flow I will get in the future, of course I will not work, and there will be no stream of cash flow, you know, and so it becomes tricky. But you have examples like think about singers, right? When they start with a label, they sell the rights to the label, and there are disputes about this. They, you know, the label has the right to all their earnings or a big chunk of it going forward, which is basically their human capital, you know?
Mm, exactly.
Or think about the football players, you know, then you have contracts, you know, of that type, of, you know.
Exactly. A common misconception, and this is like one of the most like most common arguments when I talk about human capital, is that I kind of feel that some people mix up human capital with their self-worth. And this is very strange because, as I said, like the human capital declines over time because I'm looking on it strictly from the like future income streams, and yeah, they sure. feel, but when I'm 55, I have all this experience, I have all these contacts, I have all these skills. Yeah. So I think I feel more worth at I'm 55 than at I'm 35.
And indeed, if you do, and a lot of people do, they have a very high salary.
Yeah.
So it's just the fact that they have little human capital. It's just they have few years to work still, you know. That's the only reason. But they are earning a lot of salary, a very high salary, because their productivity is extremely high, precisely for all these reasons. So it's not how much your productivity is worth. Is the present value of whatever you're going to earn late, you know, in the future. Unfortunately, we all age and we all going to die. So it has to decline over time, you know.
Yeah.
But I think it's also, I think that with aging, I mean, this is more a personal comment, like with aging, you know, like life expectancy increasing dramatically, and also us being more and more aware of the type of skills that you can develop over your life cycle. So when you're young, you have a lot of analytical skills. When you are in your 50s, then you have more an ability to synthesize, to summarize, to communicate, and things like that. I think as we are more aware of that, we can also make the best of our, you know, of our skills over time. And which, you know, for a lot of people means they don't need to retire that early. I mean, I personally am really not looking forward to retiring at 65, you know. And that's still, human capital is going to decline. But you might earn a lot of money because you're very, very useful and you're worth a lot for society, you know.
Yeah, and I always try to like, do not mix up that. This is like a strictly financial definition, but it's funny how people like were protesting about the concept due to that. I feel
it's
more
a little bit provocative. I have the same. It's provocative. It's provocative because you talk of human capital, and then, you know, I agree. It's, but we have to really just think about, you know, the you know, how much, what is the value now of all the earnings you still gonna generate as you as you age, and this includes deferred earning, which is pension. And that's the right concept to think, and the riskiness of that cash flow, hence of the value of human capital now. These are the right concept to consider when you think about investing. That's all.
Yeah. I think we're going to like wind down. We have just a few more questions. So, this is like also like kind of a bit off topic, but this has been like a big discussion, which for me is kind of related to human capital. And it was actually a book written by an author, Bill Perkins. And he said he had like a concept which was like die with zero. And he said that we're a lot of like accumulating these financial assets. And if you look at the graphs like on net worth, it kind of tends to increase over time until you die. Like, and we had this discussion with my mom, who's 70, and she's still saving. And I was like, you're 70. You have your pension. You have your house without a mortgage. What are you saving
Enjoy
for?
Life.
Exactly. Do you know if there's some like view in academia on this?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Of course there is. So,
okay. I mean, okay, so why would you leave money on the table, you know, once you're gone? First of all, because you might want to, you really care for the future generation. You want to leave money for your children. You want to leave money for society. You might leave money for, you know, for charity and things like that. And that's just something you want to do. And that's it. Okay. So, you know, if you want to do that, that's keep saving. That's very important to you. And you should do it. Now, if we take this away completely, if we take that part of saving away, then really you should only save for the consumption you're going to get yourself, okay? And the basic recommendation for saving is to keep consumption as stable as possible over time, okay? Of course, you know, as you age, you might not get as much out of your money. Perhaps, you know, you can't anymore travel as before, or you can't, you know, do certain type of sports as before. And so you might want to save less for those times because you're going to enjoy it less in a way. But to the extent that you can enjoy consumption, broadly speaking, or your standard of living, if you want, if you enjoy life, let's put it like that, to the extent you can enjoy life and you want to enjoy life, obviously, you should save considering that what you save now, you can't enjoy now. And either someone else you leave the money for will enjoy, but if we take that away, you will enjoy it later. So don't save if you don't want to leave, if you're not going to enjoy it later and you don't want to leave money to someone else afterwards. I completely agree. Mm. It's very simple, you know, borrowing means taking resources from the future to now. Yeah. So you can enjoy now something that, you know, otherwise you would have to wait to have. And we see that in housing. I want to buy a house. I want to feel it's mine. I want to renovate it. I mean, Sweden is almost the only option to buy. And that's why I take a mortgage. And how do I pay? You know, so I anticipate future income to now in order to buy the house. And obviously, I will enjoy less of this income because I need to service the mortgage. Saving means taking resources now and moving it to tomorrow. So why do you move it for tomorrow? Either for yourself or for future generation. Mm-hmm. That's the way to think about it. So your mom should say, but I really care for you. Don't you see that?
Yeah, exactly.
Don't complain.
No, but I really like the concept of thinking of it like moving consumption either like forward or back in time. Yeah. Because... I don't know if this is like getting older and getting more experience, but like a couple of years ago, I always said like, you should save this percentage or sometimes. And then I realized like for a young person that's going to make more money in the future, like saving now is kind of stupid because it's like taking money when you don't have them to give it to yourself in the future when you have a lot of money. It's kind of like Robin Hood, but the other way around, taking from the poor to give to the rich, and it should be like the other way around.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that you know, we shouldn't be scared of borrowing if this allows us to kind of have consumption more evenly, you know, spread out through our life. If anything, it's a little bit of it. I mean, not a little bit, but I think it's an issue that. But probably an unavoidable one, that we have so much money coming in because of human capital and we can't borrow against it. We can borrow it once you buy a house, okay? So, but that's the, you know, you buy for that. I mean, it's actually used, I think, you know, as long as people don't get themselves over-levered in the sense that they have leverage that they can't actually service over time, I think that actually it's good that, you know, you can keep borrowing as the house kind of appreciates, you know, in order to finance your consumption, you know, because that's one of the few ways we have to bring money from the future to today is to actually have housing.
Mm. Is it a certain type of consumption you're talking about? Like experiences, or is it like any kind?
That is really up to you. Up to you. I think that's when you have so much life in you and so much energy and you're young and having to wait another 30 years before, you know, doing the trip of your life or whatever, it's a little bit of a pity, you know.
Mm. Yeah, exactly.
And I think maybe the way around, the way to, maybe we don't know enough about, you know, labor. I think there is, we're learning a lot about labor income profiles, we call it. It's like how labor income evolves over the lifestyle, which characteristic, which risk it has, how should we think about it. There is a lot of research coming out right now because we have so much data. Perhaps if we have a better sense of labor income over the life cycle, then it might become easier to lend to people just out of that, you know, and so they could anticipate consumption. I think it would be useful, and probably at a rate that are less, more reasonable than, you know, credit cards, you know, rates that are, you know, through the roof and they become extremely expensive. Mm.
Exactly. Yeah. Also, just a side note, this was a comment from a user in the forum, Pareto. He said that one could also, that he, after the episode, he started to thinking about like exchanging like these different kind of capitals between each other. He said like, look, everybody can do like human capital for financial capital. We call that a job. But then you can choose like financial capital for human capital, like which is an education. So you can invest in your human capital, yes, by paying your financial capital.
Absolutely.
And then you can get financial capital to social capital. Like I can pay for not going to the job to go to this course, and then I'm going to meet people there, which increases my human capital, which can increase my human capital.
I love that. I love that. I think it's exactly the right way to think about it. And actually, one thing that I think it's really one people should think about, especially in Sweden, is that you can always go back to school and you don't need to pay much or even nothing, actually, to upgrade your skills. And I have a lot of friends, like they went back to take some courses in engineering to upgrade their skills. Or, you know, it's never too late to go to build up your human capital in order to change your prospects, basically, and your life standards. And I think it's an amazing thing of this country that you can do that without, you know, taking on a lot of debt. And I think it's a very important mechanism to you know, redistribute for social equality, you know, for people, for social mobility, for people at any stage in their life to move around and also upgrade the skills. And if, you know, their sector becomes obsolete or their skills become obsolete, there is possibility of adding up to that. And, you know, building a society where that is possible throughout your life, it's extremely important. Whereas when you can do that only by, you know, borrowing like crazy or investing or, you know, or when it's only available to people that have means, I think that's a huge problem. And if anything, you know, we should think about that and, you know, improve that opportunity even more.
Mm. Yeah, but there,
I mean,
are,
nowadays, when I think about when I started to work, you kind of had this kind of idea coming mostly from my parents. You get your job, you keep it for your life. You know, I mean, I think kids right now, there is no such a thing for sure, right? Mm. So you will change zillions of jobs, things change so quickly, and you constantly have to inform yourself. And by the way, you have also the possibility of informing yourself, of learning a lot through the internet and so forth. But the problem is, like, there's such a vast multitude, it's difficult to choose what is right and what is wrong, what is true and what is false.
Exactly.
Yeah, I was thinking about this social...
mobility.
Yes. Inequality. No, the social capital that you incorporate into your human capital. You don't even have to pay for it sometimes, as you said, with the education in Sweden. I mean, you can enroll in some charity or I'm going into Scouts now, for example, and I'm getting all these resources.
Yeah.
And I meet a lot of people and so on. And I wasn't thinking very much about this for, you know...
from this perspective.
Yeah, from this perspective. Mm. And... yeah, it's even free.
Yeah.
No, I think it's like a networking, there is another big. I mean, I'm not into that literature, but one big question is like why big cities are becoming so important. It's almost like, and if you think about it, like, you know, you start having this New York, London, you know, Stockholm, or, you know, I mean, maybe not Stockholm, but like, there are these. these huge cities that keep attracting people, and they become almost like a nation in themselves. They're not even representative of the country they live in, they are in, you know. What is it about it, you know? And I think part of it is precisely that, that there you have enormous opportunity to build up your social capital, which then transfers in your human capital. So putting minds together is a huge element of very high productivity and innovation and entrepreneurship and so on and so forth. So exactly. Absolutely. Mm.
It was kind of interesting. I watched the Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting this year with Warren Buffett, and he got the question like, what's the kind of the best investment you can make? And he had a long answer about investing in yourself, in education, and I think he actually said like increasing your human capital, because that's a skill set, because in the market downturn, nobody can take that away from you.
So, I mean, that's you know, as I said, the moment you do that, you enhance this cash flow. No, forget about personal gratification and everything, which I think are probably the most important factor. But you have, you know, these generate a cash flow, and it's a huge cash flow. You know, people obsess into you know how to invest, you know, in stocks, but you have that, which is enormous.
Exactly.
And that was a lot of innovation there.
And that was also kind of interesting, because I also read another book who said, like, when you're starting your like investing career, like, ignore the like what you invest in stocks, etc., because that's gonna have such a marginal effect. Like, keep increasing your skill to earn more money, because over time that's gonna increase. So it's totally
this is a little bit one of the arguments for why you should just diversify, rebalance, so you don't have to spend time on that, and still you can save, and you know it's gonna go well. You know, and probably it's the best thing you can do anyway. And then you have all the time in the world to actually, you know, invest in your human capital, in your career, in your skills.
Exactly, exactly. Next, last question, or no, two. Is there something you think we should have asked about human capital? Is there something we missed?
There is one thing more to remember, which is, again, a diversification argument. So one effect the human capital has is how much risk you take in your portfolio. Okay, so whether you invest in stocks at all, even, okay? Mm. And that depends on the nature of this, at least our best guess right now is cyclical skewness seems to be very important. That's one side. But the other thing is that if you think about diversification, you know, and this is a little bit a mystery to me why we don't see those products being, you know, available in the market. It's like, if you work in construction, you don't want to also invest in construction. Because if construction goes down, you know, not only you're going to lose your job, you're also going to, the value of your savings are going to be taken down. So you should try, there is an argument for tilting your portfolio away from fully diversified to avoid the risk that you have in your human capital. Okay. Now, this is of, you know, people tend to think, oh, I'm in construction, I know how to invest. So if you start picking stocks, then, you know, okay, maybe, you know, and then you can pick stocks. But I would say diversify, maybe take a little bit of money where you pick your stocks, okay? But when you diversify, you might not want to invest in the sector you are in. And these products actually don't exist. And the reason, I think, that it's very difficult to quantify what is the value of tilting away, okay? And I think partially is because, you know, this correlation was so low that we didn't think it was important. But now maybe with cyclical skewness, we can quantify it a little bit better. What is the value of, you know, of putting your saving not in you know, diversify away from human capital, which means your savings should not, you know, be investing in risks that are correlated to it, for example, in the same sector. Yeah. But that's, in principle, what you should do, difficult to do. There are no products out there that actually help you to do that, but it's worth thinking.
Yeah. It's actually interesting that you say it, because we had that discussion in the forum, like not putting your human capital in the same bucket as your financial capital. like if you have stock options, great, take them, but sell them when you can. So yes, you don't, so you're not exactly dependent on that. I think we saw in the US with the Enron scandal, like people lost their jobs, their careers, and their they lost pension. And their pension, the IRS thing. So yeah, so yeah, it's and this is what I love with academia and stuff, because it's a lot of like common sense. Actually, it's common sense.
But I also like very much with academia that you finally have words for phenomena.
Yeah.
That we might be intuitive for us, but all of a sudden you have data and you have like the words for it. What do you say?
Distinctions.
Yeah. Distinctions for it, yes.
Yeah, you create, you build categories that are useful to think about an issue, a market, a phenomenon. So
yeah.
And then you can talk about it and take some time to actually build up those words. Sometimes there, you know.
Yeah. We have two questions we ask all our guests. And this is like, what's the worst advice you've heard in finance?
Oof. Many. I think that. I think I remember marketing pitches that unfortunately sound okay to people and they are just outrageous, such as, for example, once a colleague of mine, she was deciding to, not a colleague in the sense of another professor, but someone I know, she was deciding how to invest some money. And then she was super happy about the type of funds she got, because they would cost 50 basis points per quarter, which means 2% per year.
That's kind of...
Okay.
And she was so proud of that. You know?
Okay. Yeah.
So just to give you an idea, it's just, for me, it's just outrageous. Unbelievable. Outrageous, exactly.
Exactly. If you would recommend a book... What's your favorite? It doesn't need to be a finance book or academia book. It can be whatever.
That's a tough one. That's a tough one, actually. But I think like one book that is very inspirational, and given the times we live in, I think it might actually generate incredible innovations in the social media type of thing, or kind of up or startup, like in terms, I think it's the book of Schiller. Now I don't remember the Missing Markets, I think it's called. Maybe I can send you, we can put it on the podcast.
Yeah,
it's a beautiful, inspirational book about the fact that if anything, we don't have enough markets. Okay, and the question is, I think it's fascinating to me that, so if you think about, I mean, and that's one of the reasons why I like financial markets and I study them. It's like financial markets is one of the social constructs that we have social institutions we have devised in order to share risk. You know, entrepreneurs come in with ideas, they need money, they sell you stocks or you lend to them. You know, at the end of the day, they share the risk of their idea with you. That's what really financial markets are about, you know. There are also insurance markets and so on and so forth, but financial markets are, from an academic point of view, purely are about sharing risk, and unfortunately, instead we think a lot only of them in terms of speculation or how much money you make and so forth. But at the end of the day, it's a way of sharing risk, and that's why you earn a return, because you take risk of someone else, and they are an amazing institution because this risk is valued. Okay, constantly, and there is a price for it. You know how much you invest and so forth, at how much you invest and so forth. And one question, if you think about it, it's like we live in a society with so many types of risks, for which there are no markets. Okay, and the question is why, and could this market be created in a smart way? And I think that's fascinating. That's up for grab, and a little bit that book can be inspirational in that sense.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Cool. I've actually missed that totally. Is it the same Robert Schiller with the data?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. The Nobel Prize winner. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's cool. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna buy it. Paolo, thank you. thank you for sharing your knowledge. Thank you for taking the time and talking to us, explaining human capital and the academia view. I really, really appreciate it. And I know I talk for a lot of listeners because your episode has been one of the most popular. So thanks again.
That's fantastic. Thank you for having me. My pleasure. Thank you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc. Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.